Hello, this is Dr. Gary Sherman, the Heart Guy, and I welcome you to another exciting and informative podcast titled The Heart Guy Presents the Heart of the Matter, bringing you interesting discussions and conversations related to the vast and important subject of heart disease and heart failure and organ donation and everything related to that in today's ever-changing world. I'm extremely honored to have as my special guest today an inspiring leader in our global heart health community, Dr. Ortega Legaspi. Dr. Ortega Legaspi received his medical degree and his PhD in the National Autonomous University of Mexico. He then came to the United States for his residency in internal medicine at Emory University in Atlanta in 2013, where he earned the Resident Teacher's Award, followed by a fellowship in cardiovascular disease at the University of Washington, where he is recognized with a 3T Teaching Tomorrow's Teachers Award. Dr. Ortega Legaspi then went on for a second fellowship in advanced heart failure and cardiac transplant in the University of Pennsylvania, where he is currently an assistant professor in clinical medicine. Dr. Ortega Legaspi, welcome to The Heart Guy Presents the Heart of the Matter.
Thank you. I'm very honored to be here and happy to share our conversation.
Yeah, no, I know this is going to be intriguing and informative. I look forward to it. So where in Mexico did you grow up and what was your childhood like?
Well, I grew up in Mexico City, So a large, crowded, fascinating city, extremely diverse and also with a lot of challenges, a lot of social disparities. You know, as a child, I was fortunate. You know, I came from what's considered in Mexico the upper middle class. My father's a physician himself, a cardiologist, in fact.
Oh, interesting.
And I had a very fortunate, you know, circumstance growing up, but it also allowed me to see the disparities in my country and deficiencies that happened there. And that's one of the reasons I pursued to do training outside of Mexico after completing my medical degree in the largest university in the country, and one of the largest in the world, in fact.
Wow.
And currently, I'm actively engaging with medical societies and medical centers in Mexico to try to start contributing back and giving back everything that the country has given me, even if it's at the moment from afar. And that's definitely close to my heart, and I'm actively working on it.
Yeah, and to your credit, I mean, there's always this giving back a theme where these people like you are just so generous with your time, because I know here you must be so busy as it is, and then on top of that, you're giving back to your roots, in essence. Yeah, so that's great to hear. Thank you for that. If it's okay, I'd like to ask you about your research experience, because for me, it sounds so interesting. Can you tell me about regenerative medicine, and what does that entail?
Right, yeah. I was fortunate enough to be part of a group of regenerative medicine at the University of Washington. So basically what that entails is trying to find mechanisms that can definitely heal something that we do in adult medicine and internal medicine, not just in cardiology, is that we control disease, but there are very few diseases that we can actually get rid of or cure. You know, heart disease alone, there are very few entities, very few pathologies that we can completely tag the patient as cured or most of the things we just control. So one of the things that's active research in many different ways is to see how we can regenerate the heart. For example, the most common heart condition is what we are generally understood as heart attacks, which is basically a blockage or an occlusion of one of the arteries that feeds blood to the heart. And that basically causes a section of the heart muscle to die and become scarred. So right. One of the things that, you know, several groups, including the very large group at the University of Washington in Seattle, are doing is to find ways to generate new muscle, whether it's through gene therapy or the use of stem cells or other mechanisms, that the ultimate goal is to generate new muscle and get rid of that scar and actively treat heart failure that way. There are other groups that have, you know, started to use sort of the heart scaffolding, the connective tissue of the heart, and generate it with new heart cells. That's been done in small animal models in groups in Boston. So that's really what it comes down to, trying to generate new tissue that's viable.
Wow. No, so the stem cells, you know, it's termed stem cell immunology. So the immune system has a role in that.
Some of the research I did has to do with oftentimes the kind of stem cells I was working on, well, we can understand those stem cells as a transplant, same thing as a transplant. So the stem cells come from a different organism. So we're talking about stem cell immunology is how to not just how to make those stem cells do what you want them to do, become the tissue you want them to become, but also not get rejected. So not get basically just literally chewed up by the immune system. So there are mechanisms that can be used as far as genetic engineering and changing the immunologic footprint of the cell for it to not be recognized by the immune system and not get destroyed. So that has to do, because a lot of the stem cells that are used right now, the easiest way to understand them is it's the same as a transplant.
Right, yeah. And going back, I know I've studied a lot about the history of therapies for advanced heart failure myself. And in the history, you know, they were able to do the transplant, but it took secondarily to figure out how to control the immune system so that the organ wouldn't be rejected. And you really need both.
Yeah. Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, that, you know, anyone that gets a heart transplant or most transplants with very few exceptions needs to be in immunosuppressive therapy for life. And that alone comes with a number of problems. I mean, oftentimes we have to tell the patients that get transplants that, you know, you're exchanging a number of problems for another set of problems. And that includes the immunologic part. The medications that are used to suppress the immune systems come with a number of side effects and potential complications long-term. Of course, this is a trade-off that's a positive in the sense that the problems, the potential problems brought by those medications is obviously a lot less than the, you know, end-stage heart failure with which these patients get transplants. But it's far from perfect. And that's why, you know, trying to come up with either a way to either repair the heart with new cells or even, you know, create a heart or a more effective mechanical device that doesn't require immunosuppression. It's where some of the research is going and where some of the future is going. Some of these research also involves, for instance, the creation of sort of immune naive or not immune response productive organs in animals. And that's the world of xenotransplants. And there is some exciting research about, you know, genetic engineering in animals that would be able to use some of these organs in humans. That's, of course, it's far from being tried in humans. Nowhere near close, anything like that. But there's definitely research on that. And that can be included in, back to your question about regenerative medicine, in which, because this brings us to another topic when it comes to transplantation, it's not just the fact that you need to be immunosuppressed, it's the fact that there aren't enough donors. You know, we have very long waiting lists of patients with end-stage heart failure, and they just aren't enough. That's just the reality. Regenerating the heart, whether it's with cells, whether it's with from an animal or making it in many ways, that all of these things, many of these things right now sound like science fiction, but that would fix all those problems.
Yeah, so interesting. I know I'm involved personally with a lot of that right now, actually, as a person who has an LVAD waiting for a transplant. And I might actually be fortunate enough to be involved with DCD heart transplantation in the very near future. So we'll see what comes of it. But I think I am making the leap from the LVAD, although I feel great with the LVAD. It's done a great job for me for 2.5 years already. But I think the journey was to get a heart, so I think I'm going to take those chances.
Right. And right now, you know, you just touched an important subject, which is how do we expand the donor pool? Since many of the things I just mentioned are probably decades away from being even tested in a human. Now, of course, patients in the list, such as yourself, you know, don't have that time. So right now, some of the things going on is how do we expand our donor pool? And one is, as you mentioned, DCD hearts, and there's some exciting research that has come out, not all from the United States, some has come out from Japan and Europe. Yeah. And there's also other techniques that have been designed to expand that donor pool. There is one thing called the heart in the box, for instance, that's designed to basically preserve the heart. Right now, if a donor becomes available, that donor has to be within 2 to 4 hours at maximum from the time the heart comes out of the donor to the time it is put into the recipient. It can be no more than 4 hours. So the box is intended to expand that time, and that might allow some donors that are remote to be able to procure those organs and use them in patients that are far away. A big example that comes out, for instance, when the donor becomes available in places like Hawaii, for instance, that they might not have a long transplant list over there or a transplant center that has the recipients ready in the list. And then, but that, you know, that heart needs to be transported to the lower 48. And of course, there's no time with the current technology, and the heart in the box provides, you know, you can use that heart in Hawaii or in places that are more remote. So there's definitely things that are closer to the clinic and have been tested in humans that are intended to expand that donor pool.
Yeah, and thank you for all that. That's a lot to digest. And it's exciting at the same time because all these things are going to advance and save lives in the future. So it's only going to get better. If I can roll back as a specialist in advanced heart failure and transplant cardiology, one of the most important and controversial aspects is really the patient selection process. So from your perspective, what is the basis for donor and recipient selection, and how did this process change in 2018?
Wow, yeah, that's a very, very important question, because we have a responsibility to the patients, and it's of course an ethical issue, that to make sure that whoever gets a transplant is set up for success. This is not something that you can do, you know, oftentimes patients will tell you, patients that for X or Y reason who are very high risk, and high risk patients, when that risk is prohibitive, they're basically called non-candidates for a transplant. Mm-hmm. And it happens for a number of reasons. And sometimes they'll tell you, well, you know, patients will tell you, if I'm basically destined to, if my survival is very low, if my, you know, my chances of dying in the next year or so is extremely high, then why not take the risk? Why not do the transplant and see what happens? And of course, that's not something you can do in the transplant world, because we have a responsibility to the patients and to the donors and the donors' families to set them up for success. So patient selection and risk stratification for heart transplant is extremely, extremely important. Yeah. And national and more of a, you know, worldwide and transplant centers expectation is that you are basically, let's just put it in quotes, allowed, or the expected mortality at 1 year is supposed to be about 10%. So, of course, a heart transplant is a risky procedure. There's no question about that. Yeah. But you shouldn't really be having more than 1 in 10 patients not making it through the first year. So that's a benchmark that needs to be set, and that's followed. And if a transplant center is taking very high risks and that mortality goes up, it can be as bad as they get closed, you know, because you really have a responsibility in selecting your patients and also your donors. You know, the risks also come from that side. There are high risk donors that you may, you know, that you sometimes need to not use. Right. So it becomes a very thin line. Now, the number of reasons for which patients may not be candidates for transplant is enormous. You know, there's a number of things, medical, some are not medical. And that's one of the reasons that all the transplant centers have a committee, a multidisciplinary committee, to analyze the cases and make these decisions on behalf of the patients and make a conclusion. So these committees are usually integrated by transplant cardiologists, the transplant surgeons, of course, but mm-hmm. there are also social workers, infectious disease specialists, nutrition, pharmacy, pre-transplant coordinators, who basically all they do is evaluate patients for transplant, etc. And then whichever other specialty might need to be involved, whether it's someone who has chronic kidney disease and a nephrologist needs to weigh in, you know, are these kidneys going to support the procedure, or do we need to consider this patient for a concomitant kidney transplant, for example? And that, of course, adds complexity. And when we're talking about multi-organ transplantations, then, of course, you also want to select well, because, you know, if patients don't do well, then you're, quote unquote, you know, you're basically wasting more than one organ. Yeah. So there's definitely a big responsibility in the transplant community to make sure that whoever is set up for transplant is that are set up for success. And that's where also things like palliative care come in hand, mm-hmm. For everyone, not just for the patients that are not candidates, but for everyone. This is a very tough procedure. It's very lengthy, as you might be able to relay yourself. You know, it's very anxiety provoking and it's very long. Yeah. So having someone involved helping the patients is very, very important. And it's definitely a big, big responsibility from the transplant centers to make sure that whichever organs are used and whichever patients are transplanted have an acceptable risk.
Yeah. And again, you mentioned the caregivers, because they need at least as much support or more emotionally for everything they have to go through in order to support the patient. And if without a support network, it's really difficult to have a patient go through this. So I think it would be close to impossible without the support that I have. So yeah, it's so interesting. And yeah, you know, I'm relatively healthy, but there are so many other conditions that many people who are in need of a new heart also have, as you suggested, like, you know, kidney disease and diabetes and all this. And I can tell our listeners also that process, that screening process, even with someone like me who's relatively healthy, is extensive, and they're very careful. They don't accept generally smokers and, you know, people who are dependent on alcohol and all that. They basically eliminate those from the recipient pool right now because of the fact that it's just, you know, we're looking for success when it comes to transplanting those organs.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Some of those things really do matter a lot.
Yeah. Besides those objective criteria, there's also, I think it's impossible to avoid subjectivity in these selection meetings. And so it brings into play the medical ethics of it. I know they portray a lot of these things in these movies that they have on television, where they're trying to decide who gets the heart, you know, who gets the organ. Can you speak a little bit about that, the medical ethics and how that complicates things?
Yeah, well, there's definitely cases that fall in the gray zone. You're right that some of the parameters are not necessarily super objective, and you can put things like numbers on them. It's a little ironic that, you know, the ideal transplant candidate is someone that's otherwise extremely healthy, right? But, you know, right. How can you be extremely healthy if you have end-stage heart failure? So, you know, we don't see that a lot. We see that occasionally, you know, you'll have a triathlete who develops sudden heart failure and then mm-hmm. it's otherwise pristine candidate. But obviously that's something that we see once a blue moon. So when it comes to the cases that are in the gray zone for X or Y reason, for instance, you know, sometimes exceptions can be made and that's one of the reasons that these things are handled by committees that have a lot of people involved, not just a single person. Right. And I can tell you that, for instance, the practice at Penn, when we feel that a patient is not a candidate, we often actually facilitate, not just recommend it, but facilitate having the case be seen by another center. You know, having another group of eyes, another committee look at the case, it matters, and it is fair, and patients deserve it. So oftentimes, depending on the cases, we actually know which centers might be able to take a case that we wouldn't take. And we say, you know what, we should probably send your case to X or Y center. Or sometimes there's a regional preferences that patients might have. And we facilitate that. Mm-hmm. That's something that's also important to say. So you know, those things matter. And we've got, you know, as a high volume transplant center, we've been on the receiving end of cases that weren't done elsewhere that we've done or we've turned down depending on the case, and we've been on the sending end. We sometimes we don't feel comfortable with a case, but we realize that it's not objective, like you said, necessarily, and we've sent it to other centers, and we've had both answers. We've had cases from ours that have been done successfully elsewhere, and we've had cases that have been turned down. And we've had cases that unfortunately were taken and have not done well. So all this is, you know, it's a tough world, and it's a life or death kind of decision.
Yes. Yeah. But it's so fair. I mean, it's as fair as you can be, you know, with the understanding that there are multiple centers available. I know I'm listed at two centers right now and, you know, in two different states. And while they both have the same compassion and the same ideal as far as my outcome is concerned, you know, they differ a little bit in their process. It's interesting to see. Yeah, I think I'm lucky to have the opinions of two centers to make sure that we've crossed our T's and dotted our I's in the best way
possible. Yeah, and that's fair. That's fair. It's a good thing. It's a good thing that some parts, you know, that we have a number of centers that have expertise. I mean, where I am in the Northeast, you can argue that one of the problems we have to get our patients transplanted is that there are a lot of centers. So it's hard. Some of our patients wait for a very long time just because, you know, the donors are there, but they go to some, they know that, and going back to the original research question you had, there are just too many patients and we don't have enough donors.
Yeah, absolutely. Not enough donors. And to that, we ask everybody to sign on that line with their, you know, at the DMV with their driver's license to make sure that they're listed, or they can do that online. So it's very nice when we ask for organ donation, whether it be deceased or living. It's appreciated for sure.
It really is. And in fact, one of the most, you know, because the United States, even though the United States is one of the countries that does the most transplants, it's also one of the most populated developed countries. So when you talk about transplants per capita, one of the countries that has the most transplants per capita is, for instance, Spain. Spain has an extremely successful transplant program. And one of the reasons, there are several reasons for their success, but one of the reasons is that their donation program is an opt-out system. It's not an opt-in. So everyone's a donor unless specified otherwise.
Exactly.
And it's worked incredibly well. Spain has a fantastic transplant program.
Wow. It's interesting to know. I may end up moving to Spain after I'm done with these two centers, but hopefully I'll get transplanted here. But it's good to know. So I had a congenitally fused aortic valve originally. That was my first bout with, heart disease. My first operation was back in 1998. And I know that you specifically treat adult congenital heart disease who have gone into heart failure and require advanced therapies. So what are some of the challenges there? And is it possible that that congenital problem that I had was the reason for my heart failure?
Well, as far as that, I don't know your case in detail, so I don't...
Yeah, no, of course. I'm sorry. Yeah, I guess in general, I'm asking that. You're right.
Happy to talk about it if you want, but that one I won't adventure because I just simply don't know.
I got you. No, now, I respect that.
In general, the congenital heart disease population is fascinating. And now, right now in the advanced heart failure world, we're dealing with, we're dealing with their success. So as of, the first and second half of the 20th century, we were seeing that, patients with especially complex congenital heart disease, in layman terms, with very messed up plumbing, so to speak, in the heart, they basically wouldn't make it to adulthood. Like, that's just the reality. But as of especially 60s, 70s, and 80s, pediatric cardiologists and the pediatric cardiac surgeons did an amazing job, like a really, truly amazing job. And they have been incredibly successful. So now we have what was basically a wave of patients that have now made it into adulthood. But they still have a problem, like I was saying at the beginning, the problems were controlled but not cured. And many of them are developing end-stage heart failure. And then if you look at the mortality, the reasons that patients with congenital heart disease die, the ones with complex disease die of heart disease. And from heart diseases, they die of heart failure. So oftentimes the only option is transplant. And these patients are extremely challenging because they've had a lot of surgeries. They're often sensitized immunologically, meaning with all the surgeries that they've had, they've usually had a lot of transfusions. So that means they've been exposed to basically somebody else's blood. Hmm. And that's basically revved up their immune system. And that narrows their donor pool because they've developed antibodies. That's a problem we see. Huh. Their anatomy is not normal. That's the original problem. So sometimes just plugging in a new normal heart, a donated heart that has normal anatomy, sometimes, the connections are not there. They're not in the right place. So it's very challenging for the surgeon. Wow. Oftentimes these patients, especially the most complex ones, have also liver disease and renal disease. So oftentimes they need, for instance, at the experience in Penn with the most complex patients, they all have received heart and livers, which of course increases the complexity enormously. And oftentimes these patients are what we call blue. A lot of the congenital heart disease conditions basically make them have poorly oxygenated blood, and they've grown and they've lived that way. But the heart that they're about to get when they get transplanted is not used to that. So that's a big challenge. And the surgical complexities around it. So it's an extremely high risk population, but it's also a population that, that needs their help. They're usually younger, in the 20s, 30s. So it's a young population. And in fact, if you look at how they do, because now as more and more of them reach adulthood, the transplants in congenital heart disease have increased. And we can see that their first year outcomes are worse. They have a higher upfront risk and the mortality is higher at 1 year. It sort of equalizes at around 5 years. And at 10 years, it's actually better. So meaning that the ones that use it well and do well in the long term will actually do better than those that all comers, all the patients that get transplanted for all the other reasons. So it's extremely interesting, but we definitely need to come up with strategies to successfully treat these patients because they're just more and more coming. And then it's devastating, but oftentimes we have to tell them that they're not candidates, and it's very hard because these are patients that have been sick their entire lives, and not all of them, but a lot of them are younger. So it's it's a very tough conversation when you have to tell them that they've run out of options. And oftentimes the patients and their families will tell you, well, we've been told this many, many times and we always do something. And we've always, we're here, alive, and now you're telling me that this is it. And it's extremely tough. So communication with these patients, even from when they're babies, talking to their families is extremely, extremely important. Yeah. But it's definitely it's a growing population. It's extremely challenging. It's very interesting, but it's tough. And and like I said originally, it's ironic. We're basically dealing with the pediatric successes, but something, we need to do something with this population.
So it's growing because of just the more people, or it's growing for a different reason. Why is it?
Well, it's growing because they're surviving. So the incidence of congenital heart disease is about the same. But the thing is that in the past, they didn't use to make it to adulthood. and now they do.
Right.
So it's like I said, right. So we're dealing with there's more because there's more success in the pediatric side, but when they become adults, right. Many of them develop heart failure, and that's their main cause of death. The main cause of death, yeah, for complex congenital heart disease is heart failure.
Right, right. And I read now they're developing like the HeartMate 3. I think it's HeartMate 3, but one of the LVADs for children now. I think they're making it available more for
yes,
young children.
Yes, and oftentimes that's another challenge. Oftentimes a very complex one, LVADs don't necessarily work. That depends on the anatomy, but many, yeah, of them, it might not work depending on their situation. That's obviously on a case-by-case basis.
Right.
But that's another challenge. Oftentimes, a durable ventricular assist devices may not be an option depending on the case.
Yeah. Yeah. I tell everybody how lucky I am. You know, sometimes people see me with my cable or my batteries and they, you know, can't believe what I've been through. But I always tell them I'm the luckiest person on earth because I'm healthy. Otherwise, I play golf. I've had this thing 2.5 years. My breathing is good. I walk wherever I want. I can travel, and it's kept me alive for all this time. So, I'm very grateful for all that. I'm grateful to doctors like you and to the technology and advancements that we're experiencing now. So I'm one of the lucky ones. But I do see other people, you know, in my LVAD support groups and such that are struggling with the LVAD, that don't accept it quite either emotionally or even physically as well as I have. So I realize there's a spectrum,
yeah, I mean,
of patients, if you
will. LVADs are fantastic. It's a fantastic technology. And it's obviously allowed many patients to either bridge to a transplant, and the ones that, for whatever reason, cannot get a transplant, you know, it's allowed a decent quality of life in a lot of cases. But it's important, like you said, it's not perfect, and some people don't necessarily do well. And you can make, yeah, the same argument as we just did with transplant, that patient selection is key. LVADs are not for everyone, and not everyone's, yes, going to do well. And I personally tell that to my patients when they're being evaluated. You know, you also need evaluation for an LVAD, and we need to see if you're going to do well. And, you know, we don't have a situation in which there aren't enough LVADs, like there aren't enough donors when it comes to transplant. But it's also a matter of ethics about you shouldn't do a procedure in someone just because. If you know that someone's, yeah, risk from getting an LVAD is sky high and it's, you know, prohibitive, basically, it's not fair to the patient to do it. It just
right,
isn't. It's much better to be honest to the patient than taking a shot, yeah, and having someone have a miserable death on an operating table or weeks after an ICU course. So that's also important.
Yeah.
So there's definitely an ethical issue. It's an important ethical topic about not doing procedures whose risk is prohibitive. Now, in well-selected patients such as yourself, LVAD is fantastic. Patients do really well.
Yeah.
The quality,
yeah,
of life is good. We've had patients that have chosen not to pursue transplant because they're doing so well on the LVAD. They're like, yeah, you know what? Getting my chest cracked open again and recovering from it. No, thank you. I'm happy with my LVAD. So that's happened in our program in a few cases.
I get you. Yeah, no, listen, I've weighed that myself extensively. But again, that's, you know, for me to figure out. And I realize I'm good. You know, it's good for me because I'm informed probably more than most. Being a doctor and a patient, I have that advantage. But it would be good for all patients to have that information, certainly, to help them try and make this very difficult decision. And by the way, it is, even for someone like me who was a relatively good candidate, it's a difficult recovery. It's a tough operation. So
it definitely
takes a lot of, yeah, it definitely is. Leading to what you're saying, that leads to the role of palliative care in the management of patients with end-stage heart disease. What does that look like?
Well, you know, I think palliative care, our colleagues for palliative care are fantastic. I honestly think that they should see all our end-stage patients. There is sometimes a limitation of how many patients they can see. But palliative care is fantastic. You know, the care coordination, the resource utilization they provide. And again, this is not just for the patients that are turned down. This is for everyone. I think it's extremely positive to have a palliative care specialist involved in the care and in the evaluation of any patient that you're considering advanced therapies. Because if you're considering advanced therapies, it means that the patient has end-stage heart failure, no matter what. Even if you're a pristine, otherwise fantastic transplant or LVAD candidate, you still have end-stage disease. You still have a condition that has a high risk of death, and you know, and having their help, having a specialist that knows how to define goals, that can put families together, that can make sure that the patients have the resources they need is extremely, extremely helpful. So in my opinion, I think they're probably funded in some institutions. And I think that they come hand in hand. And I think that advanced heart failure divisions should basically employ, partner with a palliative care specialist just for their advanced therapy. And by advanced therapy, I mean LVAD, chronic kinotropes, and transplant patients. I think it's extremely, extremely positive and extremely useful for the patients. This is all in the patient's benefit. Yeah. And again, no matter whether they're the perfect candidate or whether they're a patient, a high-risk patient who the program is going to turn down.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's important to understand that heart failure as a super specialty is relatively new. And so these things are evolving all the time as far as, you know, adding these departments for caregivers, for palliative care. It's all evolving and advancing. So, you know, we're in the middle of that history right now. So it's important to say that. And it's improving all the time. It's Dr. Juan Ortega-Legaspi. And it's been my great honor to have you as a guest on The Heart of the Matter. Thank you so much for being so clear in your explanations today for myself and our listeners. And I thank you so much for all you've done in your local community. I was a Penn grad, by the way. I love University of Pennsylvania. It's a great hospital. I did some of my training there, of course. And I thank you on behalf of the global heart healthcare community, for your incredibly inspiring personal story and your dedication to your work in an effort to help others with congenital cardiac conditions and advanced heart failure. Thank you for sharing this time with me. I hope that we can do this again soon.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Oh, yeah, sure. So that is our podcast for today. Please join me next time for another intriguing, informative, and entertaining conversation. Please visit our website at www.drheart2heart.net for upcoming podcasts. If you would like to be a guest on the Heart of the Matter podcast, please email me at theheartguyspeaks@gmail.com. Our podcast can be found on Apple iTunes, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and all you have to do is search The Heart Guy Presents The Heart of the Matter. Until next time, this is Dr. Gary Sherman wishing you peace and hope.